Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast. And because of the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S., Alex and I are based in Boston. We had a lot going on, but I am beyond thrilled that we're back. And we're going to go back to two episodes a week. So today we have a lot of cool stuff planned for you. Being Monday, finally, with international breaks over, we have our winners and losers from the Serie A weekend. We have some questions from our listeners. We got some pretty good ones on transfers as well. So I think some of our Premier League fan listeners are also going to be happy with some of the questions there. We have a little bit of pop culture at the end. We have Creed 2, Tom York in Boston. We'll get into that. And we're closing with a great interview I did with our dear friend John Solano to take a deep dive on Roma, a team that always has storylines to get to. But before we discuss all that great stuff, I'm joined by our great friend, the co-host, the producer of the show, Alex Goldberg. In the meantime, your videos on YouTube, Twitter continue to be viral. So great to have you back talking about Calcioland. So, you know, Alex, we haven't chatted in a little while. So we have two topics that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some Chelsea players linked to Milan, and I want to get your take on them. But before we get to that, I'm going to ask you a very simple question. I'm going to use the most neutral wording as I can. If you could have only one of these two players, and don't think so much Chelsea, but just in general, you have a team and you can have either Douglas Costa or Suso. Which one of the two do you want and why?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, a year ago, just not really knowing what Suso would become and not seeing what he's done this year, I would have immediately answered Douglas Costa. But honestly, I'm starting to think my answer will be flipped. I'm starting to think I will go with Suso. And like you said, I'm not thinking with my Chelsea hat on, but I am thinking about their ages. I'm thinking about what Suso could become. Suso just turned 25, so he's a fresh 25. Douglas Costa's 28. He's certainly not over the hill, but he's been around a little bit longer. And David, I think a reason why I would take Suso over Douglas Costa is I'm thinking that I am a top team, at least looking at two of these players. And for me, Douglas Costa is an excellent, excellent player, but he might be more of a super sub always in my eyes rather than necessarily a bona fide starter. Now, that might speak a little bit to just the good teams he's been on, Bayern Munich and Juventus, but still, Douglas Costa has never started more than 23 games in a league season in a European top five league. So that does concern me a little bit in terms of how much can you actually depend on Douglas Costa. When you bring him off the bench, he has blazing pace and he does have so much quality that he can really catch the opposition with their pants down, as I'd like to say. But Suso, I actually feel like I can rely a little bit more on week in, week out. Suso has had two seasons where he started at least 33 games, and that, of course, was in Serie A. And he also does have a little Premier League experience. I'm really not using that as my reason as to why, but I just like the player he's becoming. I think if they're both playing at their top level for maybe a stretch of 10 games, I actually think you're going to be getting more from Suso than necessarily Douglas Costa. But that is no hit on Douglas Costa. He might be one of the most devastating players to possibly bring off a bench. And once again, he can definitely be a spot starter. I'm not saying he can't, but I just like the way Suso's trending, David. So I'm actually going to take Suso. But like I said, if it was this time last year, I wouldn't have even spieled this long about it. I would have said Douglas Costa, but I'm going to go with Suso, David. What about you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I asked this on Twitter. Actually, both players had excellent. Douglas Costa, I'd say more so than Suso individually, although Suso as a team, the result for Milan was really excellent. So they have been on my mind for a while. And, you know, I got a lot of tweets back from some Milan fans even asking me why this was even a question, when I think they are certainly very, very close. They are in pretty different situations. As you said, Douglas Costa, I think it is fair to say, to kind of see him as a super sub. It seems Allegri kind of sees him that way, especially. I think he's become a little bit more disciplined defensively in Serie A, but he's really a juggernaut offensively, obviously has that blazing speed and that dribbling ability. I think, you know, in Serie A, those skills are really, really rare. We saw that, of course, with Salah, and we're seeing with Gervinho, who's having a renaissance in Serie A because that skill set in Italy is more valuable than maybe elsewhere. The flip side is Sousa has been a one-man wrecking crew for Milan for quite a while. He's really carried them in the past few months. He's been really outstanding. But you have to wonder, you know, if Douglas Costa was on Milan and starting all the time, would he be able to perform that way? And my answer is probably yes. And, you know, Douglas Costa has had some good performances in the Champions League. Not fair to Sousa to assume that he wouldn't. So for me, it's really, really close. I'm going to say, you know, if I put Douglas Costa on Milan, I have a pretty strong idea that he's going to be able to do most of what Sousa does. You put Sousa on Juve, he's got a different skill set, but the ability is certainly there. You know, it's interesting that both players can beat you with things that you know are going to come. Sousa has his usual move, and yet he can still execute it, and Douglas Costa has that blazing speed. So I'm curious to hear. I mean, I sent a poll on this on our Twitter account, but if any of our listeners have takes, send them in beyond picking the players. So, Alex, the other thing I wanted to ask you at the top, of course, you are one of the most prominent Chelsea figures on Twitter now, which is great to see. And some places, especially Gazzetta dello Sport, have linked three Chelsea players to Milan, and those are defender Christensen, defender Cahill, one of your favorites, and I say that sarcastically, and Fabregas. So, you know, in recent weeks, Suso's been linked to Chelsea for a while. Now we are having the opposite. So since you know these players better than the average bear, tell me which ones would you be more upset to see go, and which ones do you think could actually help Milan the most?
Yeah, well, the first one I'd definitely be most upset about would be Andreas Christensen. Christensen is still a very good young defender, 22 years old. And if you fast forward to the beginning of last year when Antonio Conte was still at the helm with Chelsea, he was playing a back three. He had Christensen penciled in as a starter, and he was a pretty damn good starter for a good half a season. Then he did have some brain farts, as I like to say. He did make some big mistakes. But honestly, I attributed that a lot to just his development. I mean, still a young defender, and he was still relatively new to the Premier League. Now, because Maurizio Sarri came in the summer, Christensen was at the World Cup, David Luiz was already at preseason. David Luiz got a leg up, as did Antonio Rudiger, and rightfully so. So Christensen all of a sudden is an odd man out. And David, I will admit, when he's gotten chances this season, he hasn't necessarily capitalized on them. But with that said, if Milan got him in any capacity, whether it was a loan or an outright deal, Milan would be getting an absolute gift, in my opinion. I'm not saying that Andreas Christensen is Matthias de Ligt from Ajax or necessarily the top echelon of young center backs, but I think he's a pretty damn good center back who still has a lot of potential to fill out. So if Milan got him for the long haul, I could literally see Romagnoli and Christensen partnering up. They played a back three. I definitely would see Christensen as part of that. He's a good passing center back as well. Not necessarily audacious passes, but definitely can spray it around. So that one would help Milan the most and upset me also the most. I think Cesc Fabregas would be the second one I'd be most upset about. I wouldn't be upset because Cesc is really on his way out with Chelsea, but I think it would help Milan the second most out of the three. I think Cesc is at the point where he's still got loads of quality, and really that quality is passing, but it's not to be overlooked. It really isn't. He's still one of the best passers probably in Europe's top five leagues. The problem is, David, he's really on the back nine. I mean, he's in his early 30s, but he kind of reminds me of Kobe Bryant, who started playing basketball in the NBA at like 17 or 18. He's got so much more mileage on his tires, so he can't play full 90s anymore. But when I look at Milan's midfield and I see Bakayoko, who actually, as you've been saying, is playing better, I see Frank Kessie. I don't see a Cesc Fabregas in their midfield, even with Abelia. I don't see the same quality they have that Cesc has with his passing. So he probably could help them from a leadership standpoint. He's a Spaniard just like Suso, and I think he definitely could be a decent situational sub for them when they really need to get more creative. Last one, Gary Cahill. I just don't see it. I mean, I'm going to be objective. I'm not going to bash the guy. I mean, he's pretty much done at Chelsea. Once upon a time, he was a very good and serviceable defender. That is certainly not the case anymore. He definitely has lost it. He makes loads of mistakes. He's not a great passing center back. So I don't know what necessarily Milan would be thinking there, other than the fact that, and David, you've pointed this out, Milan are just riddled with injuries. So if they just wanted someone who is experienced and a legitimate professional center back, fine, get Gary Cahill. But that one doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't say, it's weird to me even picturing him out of England. I don't know, maybe he could find a rebirth, but Serie A is just not a walk in the park. So, I mean, that's not the move I see him making. I see him making a move to either a worse Premier League club or like a championship side. I don't see him going to a team in Milan who's trying to get more legitimate. So that one I would not get too excited about. But Christensen for sure, Fabregas situationally, and I'm a no on Cahill. So David, now that I've spieled about those three players, how likely are any of those deals to happen?
First off, on Cahill, to me, I see him as a complete stopgap. And to me, in a way, he almost makes more sense than Christensen, unless he were to come strictly on a loan to help out Milan, because Milan already has their two center backs of the future, Romagnoli and Caldara. They've invested a lot in them. We don't know when and how Caldara can play this season. It almost feels like this might be a lost season for him. We've had Musacchio now hurt. So me, in a way, I almost see Cahill, okay, stopgap, veteran guy. How many times can Milan get away with playing, two wing backs as center backs like they did on Sunday? As far as the likelihood of the deals, I did a little bit of research on this. Milan's been linked to Fabregas for quite some time. Wouldn't shock me if eventually he goes there. January is not out of the question. Bilia is going to be out for a really long time. Let's see. Maybe that can happen. Christensen looks like a very tough deal. I was told Chelsea wouldn't want to get rid of him easily, and we'll have to see with Cahill. But the other reason why I wanted to talk about the links is, this is a good reminder. We are getting towards the January window. One thing I always tell people is it's really important to look at the context of deals. I try never to look at a transfer rumor in a vacuum. I always look at the teams involved, the agents involved. Is there any overlap? So, of course, Chelsea and Milan have actually done a decent amount of business in recent years. Pasalic, the midfielder, was now at Atalanta when they're on loan. We now have Bakayoko on Milan, also on loan, with a hefty option to buy him. And, Bakayoko's been better recently, but 40 million is a tough pill to swallow. Could Chelsea say, hey, if you're more willing to pay that clause, maybe we'll throw in this other player? So I always kind of look at it in those terms. Considering the relationship between the two clubs, it seems a little bit more likely to me. Also, a lot of the agents involved, like Pastorello, who was the broker who brought Bakayoko to Milan, also worked with Antonio Conte on his deal with Chelsea. There is a lot of overlap. Suso's agent, Lucci, also represents Cuadrado. So, these are agents and teams that work a lot together on all these deals. So when you hear about the links between Milan and a Chelsea player with Milan or vice versa, try to look at the full context instead of just looking at it in a vacuum.
Yeah, it's a good point bringing up the relationship between the two clubs. And you did mention some Suso rumors possibly to Chelsea. I get that it would be tough to really make a Christensen deal. But hey, if this was another sport, and we were in America and we could propose trades. I know there's swap deals occasionally in football, but why not just a Suso for Andreas Christensen deal? I'm down for it. Why not? So, David, that's our first segment. So we had a nice weekend of Serie A. It was really good to get the international break behind us. So this is very refreshing. Let's do an episode 172 edition of Winners and Losers.
I love this segment. Excited that it's back. So we're going to start with the first match. A lot to talk about on Roma on the loser side. A lot to talk with John Solano. I caught him hot right after the game. I think you'll enjoy the interview. But we have to highlight also the Udinese side of things. Davide Nicola, the former Crotone manager, performed the miracle of avoiding relegation for them. Wins his first match for them. Was bold. Put Kevin Lasagna on the bench, and Udinese won. They were saved once again by DePaul, who's been fantastic this season. Those are two winners. Nico Schira, who usually covers a lot of transfers, now in Gazzetta dello Sport, had an excellent tweet on Davide Nicola, and he said that Udinese in recent years, you know, had been going with the foreign managers. They brought in Velasquez, before was the youngest, I think was the youngest manager in Serie A to start the season. He was a boss. They had previously brought in former Juve player Tudor. He didn't work out, and they finally go with an Italian manager, and they were rewarded with a win. Let's see if he can continue. Another winner, and I want to lump him in with Nicolas, is another manager that had his first game on the bench for his new team, is Di Carlo at Chievo. Very surprising draw that they were able to pull off. That almost feels like a win. You have to hand it to Giampiero Ventura. The Chievo players responded to him, but the minute he left. So, good job there. Then we had Juve's easy and fairly decisive win against Spal. We already talked about Douglas Costa being electric. Cristiano Ronaldo scored his 10th goal of the season. It's been, you know, that was really quite the goal, the first one. Ronaldo makes those things look so easy. And the last Saturday match, one of my guys that I ride for the most, Kita Balde, sensational. Granted, it was Frosinone. I don't want to, you know, go too far overboard there. Had two goals and assist. I mean, that is the Kita Balde that I know. That match, and we also had Lautaro Martinez, who got an ovation from San Siro when he came out and scored. Then let's talk about Parma. They are, what a story. Now, one of our most loyal listeners, Greg Camarata, who runs an excellent Facebook group for North American Serie A fans. A lot of them listen to us. So shout out to them. He's been sending me a lot of messages on how high he is on Parma going into the season. As the season ended now, they'd have a Europa League spot. Really unbelievable. So we want to give a shout out to their goalkeeper, Sepe, had another strong performance. Gervinho continues to be outstanding. And I want to give a shout out to their sporting director, Daniele Fagiano. My friend Fabrizio Romano had an excellent article in The Guardian with an interview on Gervinho. And Gervinho talked about how Daniele Fagiano sold him on the vision he had for Parma, explained to him this was the perfect situation for Gervinho, who had, you know, other offers as well. He was set to leave China. So kudos to him. A great story going on at Parma. I'm actually working on trying to get us some really good content on them, because I got to be honest, I haven't watched them that much, but the results are excellent. And of course, that's a team with a lot of tradition. Another person that deserves a shout out is Empoli president Corsi. He was bold, made a coaching change before the international break. Iacchini came on, won his first match before the break. Granted, Iacchini was suspended yesterday, but Empoli still won. He was in the stands, so 6 points since the coaching change. Also, Empoli's most expensive purchase ever, Lagumina, who arrived from Palermo, scored a goal. So shout out to Empoli and their president, Corsi. I want to then give a shout out. Milan, I fought Cassie and Bakayoko, had a really, really good match. Cassie's been playing hurt for quite some time. Deserves a lot of credit. Milan's too decimated to also lose him, and another positive performance from Bakayoko. On the Lazio side of things, that was a disappointing draw, but off the player, off the bench, Correa has been absolutely sensational for them. It kind of reminds me a little bit of how Patrick Schick at Sampdoria was devastating off the bench, and that turned into becoming Roma's most expensive transfer ever. But Correa has been doing really well at Lazio. And I want to close on the derby in Genoa, Derby della Lanterna. I have to say, this has to be one of the best-looking derbies in the whole world. The choreography before the match from both fan bases was outstanding, really beautiful to see. I think the Marassi Stadium on TV actually looked quite good. It's not such a great place to go there in person, especially if it rains, but it looks really good on TV. And we talked about it, you and I, Alex, when we went over the best jerseys in Serie A. I pointed out that I love that Sampdoria and Genoa always have the same jersey because they're so perfect. They don't need to change them any game. A couple of shout-outs to players in that match. Sampdoria keeper Audero has been fantastic. Quagliarella scored another goal. That was his, I think, 132nd goal in Serie A. tying a very famous Inter striker, Spillo Altobelli, who was part of Italy's 1982 team. He was on the bench. It was really funny on Twitter. Gazzetta dello Sport had on their site congratulating Quagliarella, and they put a picture of Altobelli when he played one season at Juve instead of a picture of him at Inter, which was really hilarious. Altobelli had a funny tweet about this. To me, it's kind of like remembering Lou Reed for his album he did with Metallica. I mean, he had an amazing career, and you're going to remember him for such an unimportant phase of his career. So shout out to Quagliarella. On the Genoa side, Piontek scored finally off a penalty kick. But to me, the player to watch on Genoa is the other striker, Kwame, who was on Cittadella last season. He's been sensational the past few matches. Definitely a player to watch. If you play fantasy, Serie A, and you're a fantasy game or anywhere else, that's a player to watch. Flip side for the losers, we have a lot for Roma. Once again, they struggled against a lower table team. Once again, they struggled before a Champions League match, it seemed. We wish to say Dzeko starts playing well when it's at night in the Champions League. It seems that he's infected the whole team with that. I think Monchi is rightfully getting a lot of criticism. You'll hear it during the interview with John Solano. We'll get into him even more. Last second addition to the losers is Kolarov, who today did the press conference before the match against Real Madrid. And he had a quote basically saying that we waste our breath responding to fans. Like, fans just don't know much about football. And he used an analogy that he, you know, watches tennis, but he doesn't feel qualified to give advice to tennis players or basketball players. A very unfortunate take. I think, you know, maybe there is some truth to that, maybe with some fans, but you just don't say that, especially with Roma fans who are already quite upset. They met the team after the match against Udinese and told them, you know, stop being on Instagram. I think about a passage in the book Paolo Condor wrote with Totti, where Totti used to tell the foreign players that just came to Roma, if we lose a match, don't go out to the clubs after. Don't let people see you, because they're going to really give you crap for that. So Kolarov's quote, we're definitely going to have to monitor this. I see a lot is going to come off of that. And Di Francesco now is in trouble because he has the matches against Real Madrid and Inter coming, and he's going to be without Lorenzo Pellegrini, who's been Roma's best player recently. And Olsen might miss the match against Roma. So let's see what happens there. A couple more losers. We have Bologna has been struggling. Empoli, after winning two matches in a row, now Bologna find themselves in that last spot for relegation. You know, one of our favorite players on the podcast is Diarra on Napoli. But once again, he's given an opportunity to start against a lower table team. And Napoli really doesn't look the same when he plays. We saw that last year with Jorginho when he replaced Jorginho, and this was another uninspiring performance. He's a player that we really believe in on the podcast, but, you know, maybe there was a lot of hype based on a small sample side. Fiorentina, we're going to talk about in the questions, but they should definitely be concerned with what's going on there. And one thing we never have to worry about are the questions we get from our Twitter followers and our listeners. As always, you can send us questions on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, films, podcasting, journalism. Just please use the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with, if Milan beat Lazio today away from home, despite all the injuries, will you and Alex finally give them a fair shot to finish in the top four?
So this question came in before the game. And I have to say that that match, I know Milan gave up a late goal, and that always sucks when that happened. But you have to leave that match almost thinking like that's a win. So that's why I included the question. I think any Milan fan before that match, we can get a draw against Roma, against Lazio at the Olimpico. I think almost everyone would have signed for that. So let's give credit to this listener. I have to say, I'm not going to count out Milan for fourth place, but mainly based on what I'm seeing, or more what I'm not seeing from both Roma and Lazio. We know Milan are going to be active in January. They already have Paqueta in the bag. They might get Ibrahimovic. So I'm not going to dismiss Milan. I think this weekend, I know it sucks to give up a late goal, But if you're a Milan fan, you have to be thrilled with how the weekend went. Roma lost. Atalanta was in a resurgence, lost as well. You get a draw against Lazio, who once again can't beat any top team. I should have mentioned Simone Inzaghi and the losers. That is something Lazio should be concerned about. They just cannot rise to the occasion against a top team. So if you're a Milanista fan, you should feel good about it. And kudos to the listener for bringing this up.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Is Max Allegri playing Ronaldo too often? Does Juve have a backup plan if he runs out of steam or misses games?
We got multiple questions on this, Alex. And I have to say, if you're a non-Juve fan, you got to, in a way, almost say, man, those are some first world problems they have over there. And Juve even beyond a first world problem. Obviously, I have a huge lead in Serie A. I know there's a lot of, that last match against Man United and Mourinho, but that was a great performance overall for Juve. I think it's really hard to pick nits on the start of the season for Juve. So let's remember that Ronaldo doesn't play for Portugal anymore. So they're in the international break. He's not traveling to play in other matches. We know how incredibly fit he is as is. Allegri is great about rotating in general. As one of those managers that in January is probably maybe a little bit too cautious. So I have to assume because he doesn't play during the international break, Juve has to feel good about this. But let's make it even more of a first world problem. Let's say something happens to Ronaldo and he gets injured. These are the players that Juve have on their front line. Mandzukic, Dybala, Douglas Costa, Bernardeschi, Cuadrado, and Moise Kean. I think Juve is going to be okay.
Well said. All right, David, next question. What do you think Juve lacked to be invincible, and will Morata help Inter reach Juve's level?
So I know there's been a lot of talk with the new allegations on Sergio Ramos and the doping, and that made me think of that match in Cardiff that Juve lost against Real Madrid. And Charlie Stiletano, who we've had on the podcast and who's a great analyst on Sirius, the organizer of the International Champions Cup here in the U.S., I remember after that match in Cardiff, he said the main difference between Juve and Real Madrid is who they can bring off the bench. I think Real Madrid had Bale in that match, and Juve brought in Lemina or just something really, really bad. You have to admit Juve has completely bridged the gap in that regard. Just think of the players I mentioned up front just on their attack. Now, you could say Juve is maybe one great midfielder short from being absolutely flawless. I think Allegri would tell you that midfielder is Khedira, and he's been injured here or there. But I think Juve's definitely improved their depth. I think this is probably the best Juve I've ever seen in my lifetime. Our friend Paolo Condal mentioned the 83 team. I was alive, but that's a little bit before my time. So I think for Juve, there's a lot to be positive about. I think, Bentancur explosion this season is going to make you feel good. They're definitely one midfielder short, though. So let's see if they address that. Maybe a starting caliber one would be more in the summer. As far as Marotta going to Inter, it's not yet official, but everyone knows that it is. He hasn't denied it, and he was asked it publicly. The way I see it, Inter's already been doing a lot of the things that made Juve really good in recent years. You, Alex, have pointed out many times they invested in players with Serie A experience. They also signed a lot of guys on Bosman transfers, which really helped financially. I would also say that Inter really built from the back line. Their center back rotation, De Vrij, Skriniar, Miranda, is as good as any in Serie A. They improved on the wing back. So to me, they've already kind of followed a lot of the Juve blueprint. And I think Marotta coming on, and he's one of the architects from Juve, is going to keep it going even more. I pointed out in my article on Euro Fantasy Game that Marotta has great relationships with a lot of clubs in Italy. So I expect him to leverage those even more at Inter. And I think it works out pretty well because at Juve, he had Paratici more for the player scouting and the day-to-day stuff. And I think Ausilio can definitely fill that role at Inter. So I expect this to be a pretty good move for Inter. I think they're going to keep doing the things that have worked well for them.
All right, David, next Twitter question. How about this? Is it fair to say that last year Roma's success was mainly due to what Sabatini and Spalletti left behind rather than Monchi and Di Francesco?
Look, I think this is a very valid point. It's interesting because Pallotta has a great relationship of Pallotta, Roma's president, with Bandini, who was Roma's former sporting director, also worked at Spurs. He's the one that handpicked Di Francesco. So you can't, if you think Di Francesco deserves a lot of credit for last season's Champions League run, like Monchi really wasn't involved. And now they developed a really good relationship. So there's that. I would say almost all of the acquisitions that Monchi did for Roma have yet to really pan out and make an impact. You could only say Under really helped them a lot last year. A lot of the other ones have been busts, and we'll get into it in the interview with John Solano. I don't want to steal too much of that thunder. So, yeah, I think it's pretty fair to say that Sabatini and Spalletti kind of left a lot for Roma. And last season, they lived off that momentum. Let's see if that continues.
All right. David, at what point should Pioli be replaced, considering that Fiorentina built a promising young team and they now continue to struggle week in and week out?
So shout out to a friend, John Lamorte, big supporter of my work, great guy. So Fiorentina haven't won in 6 matches, 5 draws in a row and a loss. Definitely a problem. I thought they started off really strong. You know, what's interesting to me about Fiorentina is they have the second best defense in Serie A. And I think after what happened to Davide Astori at the end of last season, that would have been a big hurdle for them to keep the defense so great. And they brought in Piaka in the summer to be the third point in a great offensive trio with Simeone and Chiesa. And they haven't panned out. They have 5 goals combined. That's a problem. I think Pioli deserved a lot of credit at the start of the season, the solidity defensively, but he's got to figure it out up front. And look, you know, I go back to this for any coaching change. It's always, you can always tell me, yeah, should we sack the manager or not? My next question is going to be, who's going to replace him? Is there any chance that he's going to be better? Because for me, and look, you know, we've seen in Serie A so far, the coaching changes have helped. But it seems for the most part, they were logical replacements. Iacchini was much more pragmatic than Andreazzoli at Empoli. It worked out. Anyone would have been better than Ventura, as we saw. Now, Velasquez was in over his head at Udinese. So, you know, if they can get someone better, great. But I need to know the name and who that would be.
All right. Manchester United are after Serie A players for the January window. Should top clubs worry about losing important pieces before the season ends?
So, and we'll get into some specific targets in a second for Man United, but this is in general. And I wrote about this. I did a very premature, and that's what I called it, a guide to the January window in Serie A and Euro fantasy game. I just don't expect any of the top teams in Serie A to sell big names. Juve, Roma, Napoli, and Inter have a pretty good chance of getting out of their Champions League group. While the race for the Scudetto might already be over, there's going to be a tight race for the Champions League spots, which are really, really important. So I'd be very surprised to see any big names leave Serie A. If I had to say one that might be possible, could be Zeko. Maybe Roma just says, you know, F it, we're just going to go in full rebuild and get rid of him and give Patrick Schick a chance. But short of that, I don't see it. I mean, I'll tell everyone, let's save some time. The idea that Icardi is leaving Inter in January is completely ludicrous. So I'm going to save you some time. Don't even start projecting of the possibility of that happening. But I think you're going to see that with a lot of the players on the top teams in Serie A.
All right, David. What can you tell Manchester United fans about Fiorentina defender Milenkovic and Sampdoria's Anderson?
So I've seen these players quite a bit, but not as much as some of the people that I know. So as you know, I like to always ask people that know more than me. So for Fiorentina defender Milenkovic, not to be confused with Milinkovic-Savic, this is actually someone who's having a good season so far. I asked our great friend Chloe Beresford, who's covered Fiorentina for us, about him, and this is how she described him. Milenkovic has everything needed to be a top defender. He's level-headed, mature for his age, has positional awareness, strength, and times his tackles well. His height, 6'4", means he's good in the air and is fairly solid going forward in the right back role he plays for Fiorentina. Playing internationally at center back also proves his versatility, and it's difficult to see any major weakness in his game. So great take by Chloe. The first thing that stands out to me is he's massively tall for a right wing back and can pull that off there. So you're going to get versatility and also good ability there. As far as Sampdoria defender Anderson, if you watched the derby yesterday, he had a boo-boo on the penalty that Piontek eventually converted. But he's been a revelation this season overall. For a while, Sampdoria had the best defense in Serie A, and he was one of the main reasons for that. So I asked Marco Bovicelli, who covers the teams in Genova, including Sampdoria for Di Marzio's site. Great, great guy. Great follow on Twitter. And he told me a lot about Anderson. And he mentioned the thing that really stands out to him about Anderson is how quickly his mind works. He's great on headers, learns things very quickly. For a few months, Sampdoria, in his first season, they didn't play him at all. And manager Giampaolo, who isn't easy on the defensive phase, he's very, very demanding, wants his players to play on a tight line, focused on him, and he learned a lot. He also said that he's quite dynamic, despite not having a completely imposing physique. He's good technically. He's a meter 90 and is very good anticipating opponents. Another thing that he said is personally what he likes about is that he has a lot of charisma and is very reliable. And he said that despite only being 22 years old, he's very mature. Marco is based in Genova, and he says you hardly ever see him going out at night and that he has everything to become a great defender. So to me, in a way, Anderson, like, you know how a lot of times Serie A clubs will sell a player for big money and then they'll sign a great replacement for like a third of the money and start the cycle again? To me, if someone's interested in Skriniar, maybe you just go for Anderson and cut out the middleman, because maybe Anderson will be the new Skriniar. I'm not saying Skriniar is on the market. He's definitely not leaving in January, but something along those lines. So those are two players to watch, and a big thank you to Marco and Chloe for their contributions.
All right. Well, we're kind of moving away from football, but not really. David, what can you tell us about CalcioCast, the new podcast with good friend Matteo Bonetti?
So most important thing is I want you guys to know, like, I'm fully committed to Calcioland. Alex and I have a great thing going. I love the community that we have. We have great support from our listeners. I just look at the reviews. I know we have a great thing going. So I'm fully committed to this. Calcioland is going to continue. I know last week at CMOD, I started this other podcast and we were off, but that was because of Thanksgiving. So don't worry, Calcioland's my priority completely. I love what we're doing. So CalcioCast is going to be a little bit different. That's on Patreon. We had the first episode for free for everyone to listen. So it's subscription based. It's going to be a very different format than what we do here. I know some people have complained that Calcioland can feel a little bit scripted at times, and I think that's a fair feedback. But, you know, we are very structured. We have some segments. People that know the podcast, they think, know exactly kind of the order of how we do things. We do interviews with guests, which to me is really, really important. I love what Alex brings to the table, has a flavor. He's, although he's become a Serie A expert, kind of the flavor of a fan who isn't a huge Serie A expert. So very different. So don't worry. I think this is going to be an addition. Now, if you CalcioCast is more just the chat. Matteo and I just talk about the main storylines in Serie A. And look, I became pretty friendly with Matteo. And one thing that stood out to me is him and I never talk about Calcio. So this is our opportunity to talk about Calcio. And if you want to listen, I suggest you subscribe to Patreon. We're also going to have a lot of other cool content on there. Alex is helping us with the production up front. I'm sure he'll be involved in the project. So we'll be quite different, but I want you guys, don't worry, Calcioland is still one of my big priorities.
All right, David. Now we're really moving away from football. What's your take on Creed 2?
So this is another thing that's very different between the two podcasts. You guys know I love talking about pop culture. So I went to see Creed 2 over Thanksgiving weekend. God bless my wife. She was game to go see it. So the long and short of it review is if you go in expecting it or wanting it to be as good as the first Creed, you're going to be very disappointed. But if you love Rocky IV, or really any of the Rocky sequels, but especially Rocky IV, you're probably going to enjoy this movie quite a bit. So for me, you know, without getting too technical, when I heard that Ryan Coogler, who was the director of the original Creed and the guy who directed Black Panther with Michael B. Jordan, wasn't going to do Creed 2, I was really worried because he's a great director. His first three movies have been awesome. So I was really worried that they'd miss Coogler. I underestimated how good the director of Creed 2 is, Stephen Caple Jr. I have to say one of my favorite parts about Creed 2 is how well they developed the Drago character and his son. The images on what is supposed to be the Ukraine were great. I thought visually it was a very well done film. The cinematography is excellent. So they didn't miss Coogler's direction, but what they did miss was Coogler's script. Coogler was the co-writer of the original Creed. They somehow talked Sly Stallone into not writing the first Creed, and that's why that movie was so good. There was really no big plot holes. Everything made sense. Just a great, great movie. Creed 2 has a lot of plot holes, really a lot of inexplicable situations. The fight scenes are great. The scenes with Sly Stallone as an actor are good. I thought every scene with Dolph Lundgren, who plays the original Drago, are fantastic. To me, he's the MVP of the movie. The fight scenes are good. The direction's good. But everything else is really meh. The relationship between Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson is terrible. I could skip that whole thing. I know they're trying to make it into a movie for everyone, but I didn't dig that. So, again, if you really like Rocky IV, go see it. You'll enjoy it. Just don't expect it to be as good as Creed 1.
All right, David, last Twitter question. How was Thom Yorke's concert in Boston?
So if you guys remember the podcast we did last year with Brian Hyatt from Rolling Stone, still to this day, one of my favorite guests because he's one of the best writers on pop culture in the world. We were talking a little bit about Radiohead and Thom Yorke's Radiohead's lead singer. And look, Radiohead's probably my favorite band if it really push comes to shove. I've seen them live like 10 times. I'm a huge fan, but I had some problems with some of their politics, Thom Yorke's personality a little bit, because I kind of see Radiohead as a really socially conscious band. Something that, you know, I think most of you kind of know where I lean politically, something that I can relate a lot to them. But there were some things about Thom Yorke specifically that really rubbed me the wrong way. But this year, he completely brought me back. The two shows I saw Radiohead in Boston this summer, by far their best performances. He was absolutely amazing. And on this solo tour, he's doing a solo tour. It's kind of an electronica tour. It's with the producer from Radiohead, Nigel Godrick, who's a genius, and this awesome graphic artist who has awesome displays that go to the music. Really, really good tour. 19 songs, not even one Radiohead song. A lot of solo stuff. One song off the soundtrack for Suspiria. It was a really, really great show. Thom Yorke is just absolutely in great, great form. If he's coming to your neck of the woods, I know he's touring the U.S. right now or Europe, I would recommend it. Just don't expect any Radiohead songs. So before we get to the interview with John Solano that I record, I want to take a moment to thank all our listeners. This might come up as a humble brag and me patting myself on the back. It's really not meant to be. Okay, maybe just a little bit. But I have like so much gratitude towards a lot of the people that have been supporting my work. Last week was as good a week as I've had, you know, in my second career. I got to vote for the Guardian newspaper for the best footballer of the year. You and I, Alex, had an amazing write-up with our friend, the Bearded Genius in the UK for what we do on the podcast. Started, another podcast with Matteo Bonetti, one of the voices of Serie A here in the U.S. I was on the show with Grant Wall on his podcast. I mean, really some things that years ago would have been completely impossible for me to envision happening. So I want to thank all the people that support my work and also the people that support Alex's work. Like, I really stand on your shoulders. Like, there's a lot of great content on there. There's a lot of people that are probably much better than I am at what I do. I'm lucky. I've worked with a lot of great people that gives me a platform. But it doesn't really translate without your help. So I want to thank everyone that does this, everyone that sends in the questions, leaves reviews. Some of you have been doing it for a long time, and I know who you are. So thank you for that. So now let's get to John Solano and all the drama with Roma.
And for the interview part of the podcast, I am thrilled to be joined by my very good friend, John Solano. It's been way too long, I think, since we started the podcast. This is the longest we've gone without checking in with our great friend, John. So full disclosure, I'm catching him red hot after the game for Roma. Usually we record the interviews on Monday. We are doing it a few hours after Roma's loss against Udinese. For those of you not familiar with John, you must have not been listening to the podcast, but he is the editor of the outstanding AS Roma press site, one of my favorites, because you don't get the usual, just the same news and quotes you get from everywhere. John gets some excellent original content. So, John, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great. Wish you were catching me at a better time as far as Roma's moment went, but happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So I appreciate it. I know you're busy with your site after the game. So let me ask you very simply. We had the international break. We've had Roma once again struggling against the lower table team. So what were some of your main takeaways from what we saw today?
Oh, another incredibly frustrating match. I've tweeted this after every match that seems to follow the same pattern. I don't know if you saw it, David, but Roma could have played that match for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours, and I still don't think they would have scored a goal. It's really, really frustrating to see them against these smaller clubs, and it's the same way in Serie A every year. The small clubs, they'll sit back, they try to peg you on the break, and that's exactly what Udinese did today against Roma, and Roma simply had no response. I'd have to check the official statistics, but I believe they had nearly 78% of possession, which is just an obscene amount. I know for a fact they had over 20 shots, and to produce not even a single goal from that is embarrassing. It's pathetic. And it follows a similar pattern. Watch them against Spal, watch them against Chievo, watch them against Bologna. This team cannot come back. In fact, I don't think they've won a single match this season after having been down by even just one goal. It just shows there's several problems in tack. Character-wise, I'd say that's probably the biggest issue, and it's just maddening to see this team week after week just labor to score goals. It's preposterous given the amount of quality that I believe they have in the side.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because Di Francesco seems to always pivot to character or lack thereof after these types of matches. So today was Roma's 13th game in Serie A. They're almost done with the group stage of the Champions League. I think in Europe they've probably done better, at least in my opinion, than many would have expected. I think, in Serie A in general, with Roma, there was this feeling that maybe it would take some time because of all the new young players that they brought in, got rid of some veterans that I think you and I were both in favor of letting go, but it was going to take some time to get the team going. So let me ask you, about a third of the way in, what's your general assessment on the team without taking too much today into account, despite the fact that, as you said, this is something we've seen many times?
Well, in general, I'm pretty frustrated because the amount of points that they've left on the table is quite frustrating because, I mean, we always say, especially in the latter stages of the season in the spring, there's always that saying that you wish in the spring, you wish you had the points that you dropped in the fall and the winter. And I can't help but feel that's the perfect embodiment of this Roma. Again, dropped points to Chievo, Atalanta, Bologna, today against Udinese, Spal. I mean, if you look at those drop points alone, I mean, despite playing incredibly bad, if they would have those points, I mean, you would at least be able to take something well. They play poorly, but they're still able to manage, but they still manage results, which is what they did on Spalletti, and which is actually what they managed quite well in the later portions of the winter last season under Di Francesco. Are they where they should be? Absolutely not, particularly in the league. I think they're far off schedule. And frankly, I think they should be thanking their stars that Milan and Lazio haven't really taken advantage this season of their drop points, because frankly, they don't deserve to be sixth or seventh in the table. They deserve to be 10th or 11th because they've been terrible. They've been absolutely terrible. And I guess what you can take from all of this is the funny part is, I mean, fourth place is still manageable if you look at the table, particularly when you consider Milan's injuries.
Yeah.
You know, if Roma continue to drop points like this, I can only imagine how they feel, because Milan are just decimated with injuries. Lazio have been incredibly inconsistent as well. So they're not where they should be. But I have to say, given where they could be, it's frankly rather a miracle that they are where they are, because they could be so far off at this point of the Champions League race that it could have been out of sight so early in the season. But while it's disappointing where they are, believe it or not, I frankly think it could have been far worse.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, you were mentioning Lazio, and it almost feels, because they take care of business against the lower table teams, they always win those matches, and the way Roma and Milan are going, that might actually be enough this season to finish in top four, which I'm sure for you as a Roma fan has to be pretty frustrating.
Well, so it's funny because I think, aren't Lazio defeated against the top four or five, right? Oh, I don't think
they lost every game against the top teams. They take care of, but a match against Udinese like today, they won in Friuli. And, you know, this might be the year where it's enough. But let me ask you about some of the individual players. So one that's been really interesting to me is Brian Cristante, who had a brilliant season at Atalanta, but I kind of had a feeling it was possible. He was a Gasperini fool's gold. We've seen Atalanta make a small fortune on a lot of their players, and, you know, for the most part, they don't pan out there. I thought today he was actually one of the few bright spots on Roma, but I have to ask you, how do you see him fitting in, especially because Lorenzo Pellegrini, playing in that more advanced role, has actually surprisingly done well? You know, I follow your work. I know you were pretty disappointed with Lorenzo Pellegrini's start, but it all changed with Pastore's injury. So tell me a little bit your take on Cristante and how you see that working out with Pellegrini. Do you see them being able to play together, or is it more of one or the other?
You know, I think you took the words right out of my mouth with the fool's gold comment. Cristante is playing in a much deeper role. Roma, they play in the 4-2-3-1 now, as opposed to DiFrancesco's preferred 4-3-3, where Cristante was playing more as the mezzala role. I just don't see his long-term future playing in this deep role next to Nzonzi. I just don't, because we saw how good he did last season at Atalanta. I believe he had 9 goals, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And frankly, he was one of the most impressive youngsters in all of the league, let alone just at Atalanta, who produced just an amazing amount of youngsters year after year. As you mentioned, you know, really everything seemed to change with the injury to Pastore. And again, you said it just a second ago, I was very, very hard on Pellegrini because, frankly, he had a terrible first season at Roma. He was not well adapted to the mezzala role in Di Francesco's 4-3-3. But he came on in the derby against Lazio, scored a phenomenal goal, delivered an assist, and his entire season, not even season, his entire Roma tenure seemingly changed because he's been playing much more relaxed. It's clear. You can just see it on the pitch. He's playing much more relaxed. He has a freer mind. So given that he and Pastore will almost undoubtedly occupy that number 10 role, I just don't see how Cristante can get back into that playmaking role. And I think he's going to have to adapt to this deeper role next to Nzonzi. The problem is, I just don't think he has the defensive characteristics to really have a long-term future there. Again, he almost, you know, he scored 9 goals last season. We saw what he could do in attack, but he's not giving those attacking opportunities now in this 4-2-3-1 under DiFrancesco. So as long as DiFrancesco is at the helm, I just don't see how he gets back into his natural role as an attacking midfielder. But I also don't see how this, again, this deeper role for him is long-term, because that just doesn't fit what he does well. Frankly, I think this was more of Munchie overplaying his hand a little bit in the transfer market and not finding versatile players who could adapt to multiple formations. I think, you know, in the bigger, grander scheme of things, I think that's what a lot of the season, unfortunately, has to do with.
Yep. So let me take a small break and cheer you up with what I think is one of the better storylines on Roma. We'll get to more of the depressing topics after. But I think at the goalkeeper position, and I think today we saw it because he didn't play, how Olsen has actually been very positive overall for Roma. So give me your assessment overall. Do you feel like Alisson's departure maybe isn't one of the reasons why Roma isn't as good this season as last season?
Yeah, I don't even think, you know, you could look at the various reasons as to why Roma are where they are. And I don't even think goalkeeper would crack the top 10, maybe even the top 20. You could find a laundry list of reasons as to why they are where they are on the table. Olsen has been fantastic, and it's quite funny because Roma, you've mentioned it before on the podcast, David. The city is one of the most difficult to play in. Expectations are super high. The fan base is incredibly impatient. Very, very, very harsh at times. Olsen arrived to just a massive amount of abuse on social media. For those of you who don't remember back to that fateful day, he actually arrived 2 hours before Malcolm was supposed to arrive on his plane that seemingly got retracted back to Bordeaux before ultimately going to Barcelona. So his arrival wasn't the happiest of days for Roma supporters. So add to that there were several videos on being made of compilations of him from his time at Copenhagen, and let's just say the expectations for him were not high at all. But I have to say, aside from his first two matches where he had some shaky moments, you could easily make the case he's been the most important player for Roma. I firmly believe that he makes the save today against Udinese, and they at least get a draw because his replacement was just terrible. So I think he's been phenomenal. He's been one of the biggest difference makers for Roma this season. I can't tell you how many points he saves, and given where they are in the table, Roma need every point they can get. And Olsen has played a huge, huge role. But I think a lot of that has to do with Munchie having a lot of faith in Roma's goalkeeping coach, Severani, who is one of the most touted goalkeeping coaches in all of Europe. So it's a big indictment on Olsen himself. He's done well. He hasn't let the abuse get to him. And I also think that says a lot about Munchie and Severani, who, again, they appear to have the faith in themselves to take a punt on a goalkeeper who may not have the, you know, flashy saves like you do with an outside. So Olsen's been fantastic. I no complaints whatsoever about him.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the first two matches. I think he had a clean sheet that ended up being rather shaky. And then after that, he's been excellent. And I'm with you. I think today he avoids that goal. So let me ask you about the central striker position. I know you and I have been we've talked a lot. I've had you on the podcast a lot to talk about the Nainggolan Strootman transfers. You know, we were on the same page that they were still big names, but their performances on the pitch weren't living up to their reputation. So what do you think about Edin Dzeko? Do you think he's kind of falling into that category as well? He seems to do really well during night games in the Champions League, but not so much elsewhere. So kind of how do you assess his season so far?
Yeah, it's very puzzling. He gave an interview after he scored a brace, and I can't remember if it was against Cesca or if it was against Pilsen, but he had a brace in the Champions League, and he was asked about whether a click sort of switches on for this team when they hear that Champions League music. And he sort of smirked, and he said, yeah, that must be the case. And It was almost like he was joking, but not joking, because his team looks like a completely different squad in the Champions League versus the league. Obviously, a lot of that has to do with, you know, a lot of these city offsides that are, again, happy to sit back, play nine behind the ball, and then counter. You're not really getting a whole lot of that in Europe. But nonetheless, I mean, even from a putting forward the effort standpoint, they look like a completely different team. And I think Dzeko is one of the victims of this. And it's frustrating to see him at times where he looks like he can't be bothered. He's walking. This season, I don't know what has happened to him, but he pouts a lot more on the pitch. And his body language just isn't nearly what it was in his first few seasons at Roma. And that gets me very, very frustrated, because he's supposed to be one of the leaders. He's supposed to be one of the senatori of the dressing room. And to see him have such a poor attitude at times is really, really disappointing, because you just mentioned Strootman, Nainggolan. I mean, those were the guys that were the again, another part of the senatori within the team.
Yeah.
They had a lot of character. They had a lot of leadership. And Dzeko, frankly, just hasn't fulfilled that. And regardless of whether you and I think that Nainggolan, Strootman, whether or not they were good on the pitch, because I thought both of them were incredibly poor last season.
Yeah.
I still think a lot can be said about the lack of character and what they brought to the dressing room, which goes beyond, you know, your actual class or ability. So I think Dzeko has become a victim of his own poor attitude this season. He hasn't been working nearly as hard, and they cannot live without him, because, frankly, he looks like their only attacking piece this season. Under hasn't produced very well. El Shaarawy has 5 goals in the league, but I hate to say they're a fluke 5 goals, but they're a fluke 5 goals. You know, it can't be November and Edin Dzeko only has 2 goals in the league. It's a big, big problem. So if he continues at this rate, I mean, part of me thinks he'll undoubtedly leave in the summer. But I still think he can turn it around. He had a slow start to the season last year. He really came on in the winter. I'm hoping that's the case this year, but I wouldn't rule anything out, especially if this poor attitude of his continues.
Yeah, they seem he and his wife really seem to enjoy living in Rome, and that seems to be probably one of the biggest reasons why he's still there. So you didn't mention Patrick Schick and the other option. So I think I have a feeling kind of how you feel about him. So let me ask you, though, I think still today he's the most expensive purchase in Roma's history. He hasn't been able to play with Dzeko side by side. I don't think that's incredibly surprising to people that watch them at Samp. But let's say Dzeko's out of the equation and Schick got a long run of games. How confident would you be in his ability to be able to establish himself?
Believe it or not, I would actually be fairly confident, because the only time last season where he got a consistent run of matches came in the latter stages of the season. I believe it was April or May, and I believe he had 3 goals in 4 or 5 matches, and he did really, really well. When given a consistent opportunity. Now, he has not been good this season by any stretch of the imagination. He's been incredibly poor. He started today against Udinese. I believe he played 70 minutes, came off for Dzeko, and was very, very poor throughout. He really wasn't able to get into the match. The few times he had the ball at his feet, he was very clumsy. He was not good. However, part of me just can't get out of my head what he did at Sampdoria. And maybe I'm wrong. I do think that Roma need to help him out a little more in terms of maybe he does need to play with 2 attackers. I would love to hear what you think about that, David, because I truly do think that him having an attacking partner really helps him show his full quality, but maybe I'm just mistaken on that. I just don't think he's a true number 9.
I mean, I have to say what I saw at Sampdoria, like many others, you could not leave away not impressed watching what you saw from the guy. I mean, it was a fairly small sample size, but dribbling ability, he looked like a lot of ways like a young Ibrahimovic. It just seems, and I think this is probably more on Di Francesco than anyone else, that, you know, I think there is something to what you're saying, not being set up to succeed. So I definitely think there's something there. The way Dzeko's playing, I almost think there's really no reason why not to roll the dice with him.
Oh, so I completely agree.
Yeah, you mentioned under, and I want to ask you, I'm going to lump him in with Clivert. You mentioned Nil Shaarawy earlier. It's definitely not a good sign for Roma that although his goals have been fluky, that he's been at least their most productive winger. So between Clivert, it's definitely not a good sign. So tell me, between Clivert and under, who do you have more faith in the rest of the season?
Oh, that's a tough question. That's a really tough question. Just given what he's done in the past, I would say Under, because Under last season is following almost the exact same pattern as he is this season. He got a run of matches, and once he started scoring, he really couldn't stop. Now, I believe he only has one goal in the league, whereas Clivert has one goal in the Champions League, and frankly, neither of them have looked like threats in attack. Obviously, they're both very strong dribbling, but as far as that end product, both of them have really been lacking that this season. So just based on what they've done in the past, I would say Under, but it wouldn't shock me at all if at the end of the season, Clivert is the one who ultimately has more goals. Believe it or not, I think they should be playing together. If DiFrancesco is going to play with this 4-2-3-1, to me, it... keeping Shaarawy on the pitch makes little to no sense. I would put Clivert on the left, Under on the right. But I believe we've only seen that one time this season, which has been incredibly frustrating. For some reason, DiFrancesco really, really likes Shaarawy, despite poor performances where he just does some of the most maddening things. So, yeah, I mean, as far as your question goes, though, I say just in terms of this season at Roma, I would say I have more faith in Under.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about the transfer window. We're getting towards the end of November here in the U.S. We just celebrated Thanksgiving, so I think it's close enough to January that we can talk without speculating too much. But before I ask you what you expect from Roma in January, I want to ask you to take a step back. Let's look at Monchi's performance overall as Roma's sporting director. I wrote about this on Euro Fantasy Game, and you write a lot of great articles there as well, that it's definitely not a good sign that arguably two of the players that made the most impact this season for Roma are Santon, who, yeah, as people reminded me, was pretty bad today during the match, but overall has actually played pretty well, I would say, this season, and the replacement for the best goalkeeper in Serie A, in Alisson. So as good as Olsen has been, it's hard for him to be a net positive. So I think it says a lot about Roma that it's like this. Do you think it's fair to say that on the big purchases, so the expensive ones, we mentioned Schick earlier, we talked about Cristante, we briefly touched on Pastore, who is one of the highest paid players on Roma. I'm going to throw in Karsdorp, maybe not so fair because of the injuries, but he is someone that Roma invested pretty significantly in. Do you think it's pretty safe to say that on the big purchases so far, Monchi has really struck out completely?
Oh, undoubtedly. I don't think you could classify it as any other way. Now, I do think, as far as Pastore goes, in the matches he has played, he's actually been brilliant. A lot of people forget the derby that Roma won. He was the best player before he was forced off with injury. I just think in terms of pure quality and ability, I would probably say he's probably the best player Roma has. The biggest problem is he's never available. So that's a huge, huge problem. You mentioned Schick, Karsdorp. Yeah, I mean, these are big, big problems. Roma are not like a Juve. They don't have this massive budget. So when they do have the opportunity to spend big on a player, they absolutely, unequivocally cannot get it wrong. And Monchi has gotten a lot of things wrong, particularly this last summer. So I think it's a big, big problem. It's a huge problem. And, you know, in January, I don't know what Roma are going to have in terms of spending ability. I can't envision that it's going to be massive. But given where Roma are right now on the table, given the amount of reinforcements that they do need, if he gets it wrong again, I cannot even begin to fathom where they could ultimately end up at the end of the season, because they could be in huge, huge trouble. And, you know, I mean, the club financially is just so sensitive that missing out on the Champions League, the implications for that, I just don't even want to get into, because it would take forever to speculate. Yeah. But it would not be a good thing. So Munchie certainly has to improve. He has not been good.
So, Leb, you've covered it brilliantly on your site as Roma Press. Give us a little bit some of the names that have been linked to Roma. And as you mentioned, you know, not making the Champions League would be so devastating long term that you actually have to wonder if they have to almost make, you know, get creative and make some investments. Because as you said, as disappointing as they are, they're still kind of in striking distance where maybe they're like, you know what, it's so important that we do make it, maybe we have to figure out a way to improve the team. So tell me, what are some of the players that have already been linked to Roma so far?
Oh, one of the names we saw today was Fofana, but I don't think that will happen at all. We spoke to his agent actually, and he said there was no contact. But a lot of the papers keep saying they're going to be going after him. One name that I keep seeing just time after time is Van de Beek of Ajax. And, you know, I'm sure there's someone out there who's watched far more of him than I am that can speak better to this. But in the handful of opportunities I've had the chance to see him, he's been fantastic. And I think he would be a perfect addition, especially alongside Nzonzi. I don't know how motivated they would be to sell in the winter, just based on what we're seeing. And I think the Maurizio site had them linked to Milan the other day, right, David?
Yeah, but okay. Also to Roma. I mean, he's a Raiola. I think he's a Raiola guy, and that helps both Milan and Roma. So, he's linked to both.
Yeah, anytime there's going to be a Raiola client, they're going to be linked to Roma, at least to some degree, because he and Monchi have an absolutely fantastic relationship, far better than what Sabatini had with him. Sabatini couldn't stand the guy, believe it or not. So anytime there's a Raiola client, I'm not shocked that they're linked to Roma. But beyond those two names, I haven't seen many others linked to the club for the winter. A lot of the papers have been saying that Roma aren't going to make a big investment in the winter, which isn't shocking. But, I mean, if you saw them today, the thing that bothers me most is I don't even know if a transfer market, if you gave them a full 2-3 months to figure out the problems that they have right now, I don't know if that would be enough.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely think they need to fix that defense a little bit. I think the Fazio magic has come and gone.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, I keep seeing the Rugani link to Roma. I mean, it's not on our
side. I saw that. I can't see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, not at that price, but I mean, if I was running Roma, that would really be the place I look, because after Manolas, it's like, you know, you have to pray to get a decent performance from anyone else. And isn't that a defender that they're going to make a plus Valenza on, the one that came in for free? I forget his name. It looks like this is a Roma specialty.
Yeah, he's going to go. He'll go. We interviewed his agent like a month ago. He said it's not their ideal leave, but these guys all speak politically correct, and he's going. He'll leave.
His name? Marciano, the defender from Porto.
Yeah, Marciano. Yeah, Ivan Marciano. He's been terrible. I think he's played 4 or 5 matches, and every time he's been on the pitch, Roma haven't won a single match. So, quite an indictment.
Yeah, but at least, you know, they'll make a plusvalenza, which is
that's a scudetto.
Absolutely. So let's close on this. As I mentioned, you write fantastic articles on Euro Fantasy Game. You usually cover Roma really well there, but it's really your site and AS Roma Press, which also has a fantastic podcast. And again, what I like about this is isn't just a news aggregator where you're getting all the same news from other places. You have a lot of original content. You mentioned you interviewed Fofana's agent. So tell a little bit, our listeners, what we can expect both on the site and the podcast.
More interviews with agents. If I bother him enough, maybe a quote here and there from Palota. It depends on what kind of time you catch him and how angry he is, if he'll throw a quote away. But with the transfer market coming, a lot of stuff with agents. They love to talk. So hopefully, as the days count down closer to the opening of the window, I'll be able to provide more stuff with players and their agents, because they provide a a unique insight into the market.
Absolutely. So as always, John, fantastic to have you on. I promise we won't wait as long next time. There's always so much to talk about Roma. In the meantime, keep up the fantastic work. Everyone check out AS Roma Press. You won't be disappointed if you follow Serie A. And thanks so much for joining me today, John.
Absolutely, David. And real quick, is it Di Francesco out? Yes or no?
I go back to the fact that I don't think Donadoni and Paolo Sosa are an upgrade. But I think, you know, as you said, Roma is a very tough place to manage. And if it keeps going this way, I can't imagine that he's going to stay on much longer. I wonder how much stock, you know, the Champions League gives him. Like, you know, if they get past the group stage, which looks more likely than not, I mean, how much cachet does that give him? So I don't know. I know you're pretty determined on seeing him gone. I'm a little bit ambivalent, but we'll see. I mean, how much do you think the Champions League is going to save him overall?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I do think, especially because we mentioned the how sensitive Roma are financially, I think the further he progresses into the Champions League, regardless of the league, I think he still has that in his back pocket.
Yeah,
as sort of the trump card, so to speak, as the, well, look, club didn't go to the Champions League semifinals in 30 odd years. We advanced past the group stage again. You know, what more can I do?
But yeah,
I completely agree with you as far as.
I mean, look, you know, if they told me they can hire Conte, I would say do that tomorrow. You know, no questions asked. It's just, for me, it's always just easy to get rid of the guy. And but again, I also know how tough Roma is, and no one knows better than you. So, John, thanks again for coming on. Always a real pleasure. I'll chat with you real soon.
Awesome. Thank you again for having me, David. Take care.